Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Ukraine is under attack. Russian tanks are moving in and bombs are falling from the north, east, and south. There are casualties, but too soon to know how many. Ukrainians are hunkered down, and the sounds of sirens are blanketing the country. Reaction from the international community has been swift. President Biden is expected to speak from the White House at 9:30 a.m., and NPR will take that special coverage live. In the meantime, Alex Tavarian is an immigration attorney active in the Russian, Ukrainian, and broader Slavic community in Sacramento County. Alex joins us with what he's hearing from the friends and families that he's in contact with from thousands of miles away and here at home. Alex, welcome back to Insight. Thank you for making the time.
Thank you for having me.
Alex, you were on our show just 48 hours ago. We were talking about the possibility of an invasion that tragically has become a reality. How are you doing?
Well, we're not doing really well because as you remember, I was not the only one who could not even think that what we see right now was really happening or what, you know, that would happen. Unfortunately, gruesome events took place last night and I practically did not sleep last night, not because I was, not only because I was watching what was happening, but also because my my social media was basically just exploded because I received so many messages and calls from people from Ukraine who know me that I'm an immigration attorney, and you can understand their emotional state, and they're basically seeking help and asking what can be done because they are under attack.
Yeah. This was anticipated, as we were talking about just 2 days ago, but it was still uncertain. And just hearing what you've been going through over the last, you know, 12 to 15 hours, were you surprised when this became a reality last night?
I was. As a matter of fact, I was, because we expected that Vladimir Putin is not going to stop. He will make a move. However, we were so hopeful that whatever he did, his attacks will be limited in the areas of those undisputed territories, which are now deemed independent. However, we were hoping that the whole conflict will be around, Lugansk and Donetsk republics. However, as we know, unfortunately, Vladimir Putin moved inside the country, and so many different types of attacks were inflicted on Kyiv and Kharkiv and other cities.
What are you hearing from your friends and family about the situation in Ukraine?
Well, we just hear that people are absolutely hopeless and helpless, and they don't know what to do. I was watching coverage from Kyiv, from the capital, last night, and of course, people are panicking, and they're trying their best. They're putting their children in their vehicles, and they try to leave the city. And what we know is that once they approach the borders, women and children are allowed to leave the country. Men are not allowed to leave the country.
What, if any, resources are being organized here locally? Because we have a significant Ukrainian refugee population in Sacramento County to help people with families in Ukraine. What can people do to help?
Well, few things are happening. I know that several cities are active enough, and protests are putting together today. One protest I know for sure is going to be in San Francisco. I will not be surprised that I expect to see something soon regarding Sacramento. And also, we actually participate in fundraisers where we help victims of this war in Ukraine.
In 2014, not too long ago, Russia illegally annexed Crimea, the Ukrainian peninsula. What parallels are you feeling or seeing something similar unfold, 8 years later?
Well, I think the pattern of behavior of maniac Vladimir Putin is certainly here. Because Vladimir Putin, if you listen to the Russian federal channels, the TV channels, you will be surprised that, you will be hearing that Russia, what Russia is doing right now is actually helping to provide security to Russian people from Ukraine, which is which is hilarious enough because Ukraine does not have a capability or desire to attack Russia. And prior to these events, several government officials, including the president, Zelensky, spoke when they made it extremely clear that we do not have any plans to attack Russia. We will defend our turf, but we will not attack Russia. So going back to your questions, Vladimir Putin obviously using some phony reasons to continue entering, invading other country. That's basically it. And the irony of it all, the way I perceive it, is that if you listen to President Putin, he says that he is truly concerned with Ukraine because Ukraine is truly cooperating with NATO and Russia cannot afford having NATO so close to the country. But the irony is that if Russia invades Ukraine and will be there, they will certainly become much closer to NATO because they will be neighbors. So a lot of things that he says do not make sense. And of course, you know, experts who really understand geopolitical issues, they understand that certainly some other motives are behind this war.
Yeah. And the consequences to this ultimately are human lives. But given that the fact that the obviously the consequences to this are human lives, and given that you are also an immigration attorney, Sacramento is home to a sizable Slavic, specifically Ukrainian refugee population. The Slavic Assistance Center, located in Sacramento, estimates there are upwards of 100,000 Ukrainians that have immigrated from the former Soviet Union, USSR. Are you anticipating there will be an influx of Ukrainians seeking asylum here in the United States and California?
Well, that was the question that was posed last night on several occasions. Vicky, at this point, it's difficult for me to really comment on this because I don't know what's going to happen. Again, I listened to some experts last night, and several experts, unfortunately, said exactly the same thing, that this is just the beginning, because the plan of Vladimir Putin is, as he says, you know, we don't need the country. We don't want to invade the country. We don't want to be there. But what we do want to do is they want to basically assign the government, the pro-Russian government, to this country so that it will be sort of like Ukraine will become a puppet to Russia. So that is the plan. And of course, if that is going to happen, I assume and I expect that people will be participating in all kinds of protests. And we already see protests not only in Ukraine today, we already see protests in Georgia, we see protests in Russia. And of course, if that is going to be the pattern of behavior from the Russian side, I do expect that a lot of Ukrainians will flee.
What would that road to immigration look like?
Well, It will certainly be, in my opinion, unless the U.S. government will work on some sort of a program where some sort of a quote will be assigned to Ukraine, allowing people which would meet certain requirements to basically enter the United States and stay here permanently. Unless that happens, I assume that people will just run for their lives. And I assume that these individuals will probably fly to Mexico and will be seeking asylum at the southern border.
There's just still so much that is unfolding. What will you be focusing on in the weeks ahead?
I think I will be focusing on, like I said earlier, I will be focusing on receiving many phone calls, which already started, and many Skype calls. And the main question that I have right now, which, like I said, I received exactly identical questions last night. People need help, and people ask me what can be done from my side to help them. And it's very tragic because I had several calls yesterday when women at night would call me and they say, I have a 14-year-old kid. I have a 10-year-old kid there. What can be done, Alex? So that is what I expect I will be hearing.
Well, thank you for answering those calls and taking the time to speak with us, Alex.
You're very welcome, Vicky. Thank you for having me.
Alex Tavarian is an immigration attorney active in the Ukrainian, Russian, and broader Slavic community in Sacramento County. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. Well, clearly the human cost of the Russian invasion of Ukraine is at top of heart and mind, but as one of the largest producers of crude oil and natural gas, the Russian military conflict and sanctions are shaking the global economy, with ripple effects reaching the United States and California. Global oil prices rose above $100 a barrel for the first time since 2014, and natural gas prices are also climbing. This comes, and it's likely no surprise, that the United States is experiencing its highest inflation levels in 40 years. $3.54 is the average cost of gas per gallon as of this morning, but that is nationwide, according to AAA. In California, that average price is more than a dollar over the national average, $4.77 per gallon, a record high, with some areas in the state topping $5. Severin Bornstein is the faculty director at the Energy Institute at Haas at UC Berkeley and joins us to explain how we're feeling the economic cost more than 6,000 miles away. Severin, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, when talking about the economic impacts of this Russian invasion of Ukraine and subsequent military strikes, it's usually looked at with a national lens. And as exemplified by the average price of gas in California, that does leave some room for exploring California specifically. Your field is oil and natural gas. What is happening in California?
Well, gas prices have been rising. We've seen the price of crude oil go up about $20 a barrel over the last month as people were anticipating this invasion. And now that it's happened, oil has jumped a bit more, but actually not that much. It was already very high. That translates, when you look at the increase in oil prices and natural gas prices and translated that to consumers, not just at the pump, but in higher costs of goods, in higher heating prices, that translates to about a dollar and a half a day higher prices.
Wow.
So it's hitting per person. And that, so it's hitting everybody. For moderate and wealthy people, that's probably not something that's going to be a major pinch, particularly in California when you compare it to, for instance, housing prices. But for lower income people, this will be one more thing added on to all the other rising costs that they're facing.
Yeah. What is a nuisance to some people is devastating to underserved communities. And given that it's a record now, but this conflict is far from over, sanctions have been imposed, more are expected. Is this price of gas, is it just expected to continue to rise?
Well, two things. First of all, although it is a record in nominal terms, when you adjust for inflation, it's actually not even close. We had higher prices back in 2007 and 2010 to 2014. And earnings have gone up as well. So when you look at the affordability, it's definitely worse than it was a few years ago, but this is not a really unprecedented event. When you look at the future, you know, the oil market has a hard time predicting what's going to happen. But the futures market trades oil for delivery a month or 6 months or a year from now. And the year from now price for crude oil is actually much lower, more than $10 a barrel below the current price. So what that says is the best guess is that the oil market will stabilize and will gradually drift down. But, you know, there's huge uncertainty. If Russia pulls back, or even if they just install a puppet regime in Ukraine, I think the oil market is likely to stabilize. We will impose real sanctions on Russia, but I'm pretty sure they will still find ways to sell their oil. I do want to add that, you know, the thing that Americans can do individually that would be most effective fighting the Russian invasion is use less oil. Mm. Because if the price of oil goes down, Russia has less money. And if they have less money, they're less likely to engage in these sorts of international excursions. So this very high price of oil, to the extent that they can still sell their oil, actually benefits them.
Yeah, supply and demand. I want to go back to what President Biden announced when he initially announced sanctions back on Tuesday. He said that the White House would work to keep gas prices from skyrocketing. What tools does the White House realistically have?
Well, it doesn't have a lot of tools. And, you know, presidents always do this and say that they're going to try to push down gas prices. One possibility is to release more oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, and I suspect we will be hearing about that. It will have a modest effect. Certainly, we are now seeing a lot more drilling in the United States, which took a while to pick up after the pandemic, but is now picking up, and that will help push down oil prices. But there is definitely a tension. If we are going to really impose sanctions on Russia that bite, the way you do that is preventing them from selling oil. And that is happening already. And to the extent that happens, that pushes up world oil prices. So I think he has very limited means. There will be discussions of cutting the sales tax on gasoline. The federal gas tax, which is all Biden could influence, is 18 cents a gallon. That's not going to make a big dent. And I think there's real pushback on even cutting that because those revenues go to things like roads and infrastructure and are needed.
One of the last times the U.S. imposed sanctions on Russia was in response to the illegal annexation of the Ukrainian peninsula of Crimea. That is also the last time the price of oil went over $100 a barrel. That was back in 2014. Did that play a role back then? Are there any parallels to draw from this?
Not really. Actually, if you look back at the price of oil over that time period, it was rising and was already very high. It was very close to $100 for 3 or 4 years before it went over. So that's really not, there wasn't much world reaction. And I think people would generally agree there wasn't much in the way of sanctions on Russia at the time. They continued to sell oil. The price of oil, in fact, collapsed in late 2014 due to excess supply in the market. So that really isn't a parallel to what I anticipate that Biden is considering now, which are much more severe sanctions, financial restrictions that could potentially cut off Russia's ability to sell oil. The closest parallel, in fact, is around 2010 or 11 when we imposed sanctions on Iran and made it very difficult for them to sell oil. And that did tighten up the oil market a bit, but it had very severe financial effects on Iran that eventually led to an arms control deal with them.
Well, then that brings me to supply, because California doesn't import oil from Russia. The state's largest importers are Ecuador, followed by Saudi Arabia. So why isn't California buffered from this impact?
Well, the price of oil is set in the world oil market because oil is moved around to wherever the highest price is. So where we actually buy our oil from is irrelevant in the sense of the price. There is good news now compared to 10 years ago and 20 years ago, which is the United States as a whole produces just about as much oil as we consume. So that means and we do with natural gas too. That means when those prices go up, if you're a buyer, you still feel the pinch. But a lot of that revenue is now going to producers in the United States who are hiring workers, who are paying taxes, and that money gets recirculated in the economy. And that's why the rise in the price of oil and natural gas this time, I think, is much less likely to cause an economic downturn in the economy as a whole. It will cause buyers to be made worse off, but there are also a lot of sellers in the United States who will be made better off by getting those high prices.
Okay, so that brings me to natural gas, because this plays a role as well. When talking about this specific military conflict, I hear about Russia's natural gas supply and exports as it relates to Europe. In Europe, natural gas prices were up by like 30% as of this morning. What is the impact on the United States or California, if any?
Very minimal, because although oil is traded in a world market, natural gas is not. It's very hard to move natural gas across borders, across continents. And as a result, we don't ship a lot of natural gas and our market is not very integrated, which is why our price is about a fifth of the European price right now. We have been shipping a lot of liquefied natural gas to Europe, which is a big deal to the European market, but it's a fairly small part of the US market. So it hasn't really had much influence on natural gas prices here, whereas it's been a huge help, and I think is critical to helping the Europeans weather the real energy storm they're going to face as Russia very likely cuts off natural gas supplies to Western Europe.
Finally, you touched upon how, you know, the spiking oil and natural gas market obviously affects the broader economy, and the cost of really seemingly everything feels like it's going up. Inflation is already taking place. It's at its highest level in four decades. What role is the energy market playing in this in terms of a projection? Are we plateauing, or should we just expect all of this to accelerate?
Well, it's definitely not good news in the short run for inflation, because it will push up crude oil prices and gasoline and other products, as well as natural gas, which will push up electricity and home heating and so forth. But these, unlike the sort of inflation we think of, for instance, in wages and food and other things, where you think of it as just rolling along, I think energy prices are much more up and down. So yes, they're very high right now, but the markets actually anticipate they will go down, that the nominal prices will drop over the next year. And so over the next couple of years, I think they could actually help put a brake on inflation. But in the next few months, it's very likely to contribute to higher inflation reports.
Professor Bornstein, thank you so much for just breaking all of that down for us.
Thanks for including me.
Severin Bornstein is the faculty director at the Energy Institute at Haas at UC Berkeley. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. All right, we are back. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. No person of African, Asiatic, or Mongolian descent shall be allowed to purchase, own, or lease said property. That is the language thousands of home buyers and sellers in the Reno-Sparks metro area are discovering on their property records. These racial covenants aren't unique to homes in northern Nevada. These restrictive and racist relics from the past can be found in the property records of homes across the country. Although they were banned nationwide over 40 years ago, their language lives on and in some cases cannot be removed. There is even debate across the country on whether removing them will help or hinder the effort to build a more inclusive future. But Washoe County is empowering residents who own or are interested in buying these homes with the opportunity to disavow these racial covenants. It has done so through a two-year effort to bring these records into the digital age. Here to lay out this opportunity for Reno and Sparks residents is Washoe County Recorder Kaylee Wark and Alexis Hill with the Washoe County Board of Commissioners. Kaylee and Alexis, welcome to Insight.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Morning.
Good morning. Well, Alexis, starting with you, this issue began for you about a decade ago when you purchased your home in Reno. Share with us what happened.
Yes, I purchased my home in 2012, and when we were closing on the house and signing the final documents, I noticed the racial covenant language from CCNRs that were no longer legal. They had a stamp that they no longer could be upheld. However, incredibly offensive language, and the realtor told us that we had to sign those racial covenants to close on the house. So we had to sign documents that said that people of color couldn't live in our neighborhood. So that was very upsetting. And I'm so glad that there's an opportunity for residents in our community to disavow that language now.
Yeah, that awareness is so important. Kaylee, as the recorder, can you tell us more about these racial covenants, where they actually are in the Reno and Sparks area, and how early did they actually begin in Washoe County?
Sure. Well, during most of the 20th century, racial restrictive deeds were prevalent throughout property transactions to keep people who are not white from buying or occupying land. And of course, we see this in the Reno-Sparks area and throughout communities across the nation. These covenants typically include a clause that states, you know, said premises shall not be conveyed or occupied at any time by any person other than the white or Caucasian race, except domestic servants of a different race. These CC&Rs made it really difficult for minorities to rent, lease, buy a property in many subdivisions beginning as early as the 1920s.
I mean, awareness is one thing. Political will is an entirely other thing. Alexis, what led to the county working over really the past 2 years to empower residents who own or are interested in buying these homes with these racial covenants?
Well, what is exciting is that our recorder has been on the cutting edge of doing these things of, you know, ensuring that people know the history of our property records and ensure that, you know, we can do something about disavowing this language. She worked at the state level to make this law pass, where you can sign a piece of paper to disavow the language. And I found out from my constituents that to disavow the language, it costs $43, because in code, the recorder's office must charge fees. So it's not a fee that Kaylee herself, our recorder, could waive. So I took it upon myself to use my commission discretionary funds to allow people in all over our county to disavow this language. And I would deposit the fees into Kaylee's into her account, so that people would not have to pay to disavow them.
Wow. Well, Kaylee, walk us through it. The recorder's office has spent the last 2 years digitizing all of Washoe County's property records. Walk a homeowner through this. How can they do this process?
Yeah, so this project was actually a result of a large-scale digitization effort that we had planned for disaster recovery. And at the same time, we're having these conversations at the legislature for this new form, the adopted form. We call it in Nevada, it's the Declaration of Removal of Discriminatory Restriction. And we realized that our scanning and indexing project could be used by the public to identify racial covenants in a much simpler fashion, given its OCR capabilities. And so really, now this online system has those search features that you can do from your computer remotely, right? Prior to this year, citizens would need to physically come to our office and look through books or search on microfiche for hours and conduct this historical research. Our biggest challenge was really not releasing this technology sooner. We're really excited. It was a two-year endeavor to digitize almost 5 million records. But the demand for this technology has been high in our community, and researchers have been really seeking out our historical property records for this reason.
Well, Alexis, given that these records are now available for the public, and you've even put in discretionary funds to remove financial barriers, what response have you seen from the community? Because Kaylee was talking about there being a demand for this.
Absolutely. I've heard from many of my neighbors who were ecstatic that they could even remove the language. They were not keeping up with what was happening on the state level at the legislature. So to understand that they could fill out that paperwork, it wouldn't cost them a fee, and they could say that they disavow the language. I've been hearing a really warm response. And there's a lot of people in our community who want to ensure that we're not forgetting this history. And I think our recorder has done a great job. She, for Black History Month, she put up a display about racial covenants at the county complex. And I know that we're seeing how we can partner with the University of Nevada to map out these racial covenants. So it's really clear that, you know, these were barriers to home ownership and also to really investment in our community by people of color, and that we need to recognize this and make sure that we don't forget our history.
Yeah. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're learning more about a Washoe County initiative making it easier for homeowners to disavow racist covenants and property records. And if you are just joining us and you're expecting to hear President Biden addressing the Russian invasion of Ukraine, his speech has been pushed back to 10:30 a.m., and NPR will carry that special coverage live. That brings me to laws that have been passed not only in Nevada, but also across the country. In 2019, a law was passed in Nevada for these racial covenants to be disavowed. What exactly does disavowed mean, Kaylee?
That's a common question I've received from my constituents as well. Nevada opted for a declaration form that can be recorded really as an act of symbolism. It seems a symbolism to denounce that racist language. And so when that form is then recorded in our office or any county recorder's office throughout the state, we attach that to the original record, and that goes forward with the chain of title. Whereas California, I think, has recently taken a more fruitful approach and has the ability to modify future copies produced while still maintaining the original instrument. Denouncing this language here in Nevada, this is certainly statutory and would take further changes at the state legislature to adopt new policies. But that's how we do it today, through that declaration form.
Why can't they just be erased from the records?
It's statutory in nature. And so the recorders, even with that form being recorded at the recorder's office, our county recorders in Nevada don't have the statutory requirements or ability to go ahead and redact that original language. Mm. And I think this is a really complex problem, right? Because historians would like us to remove or erase our original instruments. We need to keep and maintain that original record. But I think there is a path forward in the future, certainly here in Nevada, to do more and adopt new policies in the future.
Yeah, and that's right, Kaylee. There is debate across the country on whether these covenants should be removed. Some argue removing them is erasing history and could stall efforts to make amends to the communities of color today. Alexis, how do you unpack all of this? How do you navigate that?
I think that's a great question and something that we need to continue to engage with our communities of color here in Washoe County. We have a really active NAACP chapter that I want to work with to see, do you want to see the county push during the state legislature for erasure of these covenants, if there's some policies put in place that we ensure that we still keep them and there's, you know, some sort of historic record kept, or is the disavowing enough? I think that we really need to work through this because this is such a new issue new to the community dialogue, I would say, issue. And so it's a question of, okay, so if someone wants to buy a house in a neighborhood that is from the 1920s to 1950s, and they're a person of color and they have to sign these covenants, is that a problem? Is that a hurtful reminder of the history, or is that a recognition of the history? I think that dialogue needs to be had in our community. We have thought of some things that we could bring to the state legislature or have sponsored by one of our senators, and it would allow for counties to opt in to removing the language. But again, it's a constant dialogue that we need to have to make sure that, you know, we're listening to our community and keeping our history, and also, you know, doing what's best for the citizens of Washoe County.
Yeah, that's right, Alexis. I mean, this is decades in the making. Racial covenants were struck down by the Supreme Court in 1948. They were outlawed nationally with the Fair Housing Act in 1968. What do you believe has been the lasting impact of covenants that has had on your community, given that you're talking with your constituents and your neighbors?
Well, I'll tell you, the biggest way that Americans save and save for retirement is their home. And so when you think that people were restricted from buying homes in communities that actually had an increase in value, that is a lasting financial impact in our community and something that we need to recognize that we've actually pushed people of color in our community who have lived here for decades down because of that. So that's a discussion that we need to continue to have. And that's why I think it's really important that, thank you so much for highlighting this and, you know, for us to continue the dialogue locally. And I'm hoping other communities also do this.
Yeah. And the barriers to generational wealth are felt today, generations later. Kaylee, ending with you, digitizing these records is completed. And what do you hope people in your community take away from this?
My hope is that this opens up the dialogue and it promotes action, because recycling this racist language back into our community with each real estate transaction is not reasonable. I hope that main takeaway from here is that homeowners contact their local recorder's office and denounce this language with the form when they're given the opportunity, right? And we have that opportunity here in Washoe County, thanks to Commissioner Hill's discretionary funding to help promote this here locally. So I would certainly take advantage of that for homeowners in communities with this racist language.
Kaylee and Alexis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
Kaylee Work is the Washoe County Recorder, and Alexis Hill is with the Washoe County Board of Commissioners, explaining how the county is making it easier for thousands of Reno Sparks residents to discover and disavow racial covenants. Still ahead, brewing community and culture. A Black women-led family-owned business is elevating the coffee shop game. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. If you're joining us expecting to hear President Biden addressing the Russian invasion of Ukraine, his speech has been pushed back to 10:30 a.m., and Cap Radio will bring you live NPR special coverage then. In the meantime, when it comes to building cultural bridges and uplifting underserved communities, most people wouldn't say it begins with a cup of coffee, but for three Sacramento sisters, a cup of coffee is the perfect place to start. With a passion for brewing community and culture, Drip Espresso in Midtown Sacramento has opened with the promise of being more than just a coffee shop. This Black-owned family business seeks to empower and build relationships with those who've been historically disenfranchised. They say their door is open for anyone willing to connect, learn, and engage with one another. Joining us now is Kiana Williamson, one of the owners of Drip Espresso, and she's here to share their dream of going beyond coffee to uplift and strengthen their community. Kiana, welcome to Insight. Thanks for joining us and congratulations on your soft opening.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having us. We're all so excited to be here or to be on with you. My sister Jasmine and my sister Taylor, they wish they could have joined, but they want to just say hello to everyone listening.
Oh, there'll be plenty of time to catch up and get to know each other. Congratulations on opening up. I mean, this is a new business, Kiana, but you're no stranger to Sacramento and the needs that should be filled in your community. If you can just share a little bit about your family history and what led to Drip Espresso.
Yeah, absolutely. I was born and raised in Sacramento. I lived in the Oak Park area. I went to Father Keith B. Kinney Elementary School, Kit Carson. I went to Cal for a little bit and ended my sort of Sacramento education career at Sacramento High School. We grew up in a family where community has always been first. My grandmother owned a daycare in Oak Park called Seeds for Sprouts daycare, and we serviced children from the Oak Park area. I just returned in 2020 as an editor for the Sacramento Bee, where I founded the Equity Lab. So it's been a passion of mine since as long as I can remember to provide space for community and to be a part of the solution when it comes to misinformation, disinformation, and local civic culture.
And your coffee shop, this is so interesting, is located near 24th and J Streets in Midtown, where Good Vibes Vegan Cafe, which was owned and operated by your parents. What can you tell us about your parents and how they inspired you to pursue this dream?
Absolutely. So the sisters who own Drip, we are a blended family. Two of us have the same mother. Two of us share the same father. And Jasmine Bronson's mother, my stepsister, Jada Barnes, and her late husband, Lenny Barnes, built Good Vibes Vegan from scratch. And they finally found a brick and mortar to serve the community. They took a completely empty space and renovated it, brought in local artists to paint, and bought all this equipment. And unfortunately, Lenny passed away and Jada sort of lost the oomph to want to continue without her business partner. So Jasmine, you know, convinced her mom, like, hey, give us a shot. We have a strong idea for a community and cultural space. We're going to serve coffee in small bites. Like, let us have the space. She agreed. And since October of 2021, we've been building up this space to serve our local community.
Your shop is committed to supporting underserved communities by also sourcing local ingredients exclusively from BIPOC, Black, Indigenous, people of color, women, LGBTQ plus vendors. How did you set out building those connections and those bridges?
Yeah, well, our vision is to empower and partner with communities who are familiar and similar to our circumstances, which happen to sometimes be systemically disenfranchised because of our class, our gender, our race, religion, and our sexuality. And we have a specific and a greater urgency to work with working class folks and women of color. So we thought the best way to do this was to achieve a supply chain that's exclusively powered by these communities. And so it took a lot of digging. And one of the first things we did was we asked the community. We've been so well received from the community through social media that we put out posts. Who are your favorite local roasters that are of these communities? Who are your favorite bread suppliers? Who do you get your produce from? And it's really taken a huge effort from our entire village to find and identify these folks. And so currently we're sourcing our beans from Black Coffee Roastery, which is ran and owned by Dante, who has been doing this since the start of the pandemic, and who, because of our business, was able to expand his own business, buying more equipment to better service his area and our restaurant as well. So we really pride ourselves on being able to open doors that historically have been shut for roasters who identify in ways that he does.
I'm curious, Kiana, given that you're formerly with the Sacramento Bee and you founded the Equity Lab, did that give you a better lens in seeing what is missing in the community and leading you to open up Drip Espresso to hopefully fill those gaps and elevate it?
Absolutely. You know, I hope to be a part of the solution when it comes to misinformation and disinformation in communities that have long been underserved by mainstream media. That was the mission at the Equity Lab, and it is a personal life mission of mine. And I think that with Drip, it gives me a little more freedom to do that in untraditional ways. So we, you know, sat at the table and we thought, what is the best connector of people? And coffee was one of the first things that came to mind. So we set out in early October to build a space that not only was going to serve our community by delivering great espresso, great food, but also that we were going to be socially conscious and make sure that we activated and empower an entire community of people to feel like they can participate in local democracy.
All right. Well, on that note, let's get to the yummy stuff. What are your favorite items on the menu?
Oh, absolutely. So I'm actually a new coffee drinker. So we have a drink called the Golden Hour, which is a mix of turmeric, coriander, black pepper, cinnamon, and hazelnut.
Oh, I love
and
that.
And it comes with, oh, it's so good. And it comes with or without espresso. So for all the folks who love espresso, who don't love espresso, this is the perfect starter drink to introduce yourself to us. And then we were told, I don't know if this is true. You'll have to come, you know, tell us yourself, but that we have one of the best avocado toast in Sacramento. Mm. It's avocado. It's named after my mother. It's called the Gigi. It's avocado, cherry tomatoes, fried garlic, and in-house pickled purple onions. It is to die for.
You also are going to feature works of art from local artists. Kind of give us a taste of what that will look like.
Absolutely. So we were incredibly inspired by just the new movement of business owners in Sacramento and in Midtown, especially when we think of folks like Faith J. McKinney, who currently has a pop-up art gallery in Midtown Sacramento. Right behind the ice blocks. We knew that there was opportunity to partner with folks like her, who's a curator, to make sure that we are also supporting local artists by bringing in art that is at affordable prices for our community to potentially buy. So we're hoping that as we continue to walk the way of our our coffee shop, that we're adding on elements that continues to further support the community. And a part of that will be partnering with Faith J. McKinney to curate art inside the space that we can both help our local artists sell and also give folks entry point into the art buying world.
Yeah, I love Faith. I've been to one of her exhibits and it's that they're beautiful and powerful. And you also had the soft launch last weekend, correct?
Correct. And we have another soft launch this weekend as well. We're still working toward our opening. We're about one inspection away from receiving our permit, and which should come any day now. But what we're focused on is just building the community now and testing out our recipes to make sure that we are actually providing something of value that the community wants. So if you want to come out, taste out, and be a part of that process, we are hosting an event this Saturday and Sunday from 7:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m.
Oh, that's great. How did it feel welcoming people into your business for the first time last weekend?
Oh, it was amazing. There was about 200 people that showed out over the course of, you know, the 2 days. We had folks from as far out as Stockton in Las Vegas who saw us on the news and who wanted to come be a part of
Las Vegas.
What we were building
here. Wow.
Oh, my God. We were literally floored. We took pictures with everyone. You know, something that, you know, I told my sisters is that, you know, maybe people will initially support because we're women, we're Black, we're young, we're, you know, providing something new, but they're only going to stay if we're providing value. So it has been incredibly awesome to get all the emails, the texts, the social media DMs, the calls all day and night asking, when are you opening? When can we come? It's been amazing. We actually call all of our supporters besties because we want everyone to feel like we're a part of one big happy family.
And now you're carrying on your family's legacy and dreams through this coffee shop. That's amazing and really powerful.
Thank you so much. You know, it is a dream come true, you know, one, to provide space in Sacramento, but really to do it with family. You know, running and starting business is not an easy task, and doing it with family probably adds another layer to that. But as sisters, as mothers, as homeowners, as folks who are invested in the future of this region, we really are taking that into consideration with every decision that we make. We're being intentional about building the world that we want to live in, that we want our children to live in. And so literally, this is a dream come true.
You're also getting me hungry with that avocado toast and that turmeric latte. Kiana, thank you so much for joining us and congratulations.
Thank you so much. Well, we can come on anytime. Just give us a call.
You're always welcome. Kiana Williamson is the co-owner of Drip Espresso in Midtown Sacramento, a coffee shop with a passion for brewing strong coffee, community, and culture. They have a soft opening this weekend. That's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Nick Dobis, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer, Stephen Starbuck. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here on Monday.